After Ba'anansi became Anansi the Spider, he traveled around the place that white men called the New World. But the New World was not new at all. Empires had risen and fell on the shores of the islands and in the mountains of the wild continent. In the wind, Anansi could read the stories of the already almost forgotten people, with names like Kangaree, Ino, Pahoy, and Mayaka. But there were new stories being written as well. Those bodies that survived the water were strong, and they were put on platforms and traded for paper and coins. But for some of them that were sold, the minds were even stronger. Strong enough that they could not be broken by the whip, or the sun, the hate, or the indifference. Anansi found the stories that he came for, growing in the fields, drifting like ghosts in the enormous houses, etched in the suffering of the weak and the fighting of the strong. Welcome to Chapter 2. My name is History, and as always, I am your reliable collector of the forgotten fantasies, stories gathered from historical narratives so remarkable that they caused the god to give up its power and venture to a place where it was not really known. Last time, the runaway slave poet Mamadou's records show us how Kamau reached the island, the Obaifo likely transforming itself into a firefly to escape the hull of the slave ship, the Bloody Princess. Kamau had undertaken the long and terrible voyage in search of his lover, the witch Asa. For the benefit of listeners who may be unfamiliar with Obaifo lore, let us pause here and include some brief exposition. It may be difficult to understand how Kamau was able to track Asa across the ocean and to the exact island where she had been taken. You see, historians and followers of the occult alike know that unlike the vampires of modern lore, the Obaifo had never been human. They were a supernatural race as old as the mountains. In the book, Vampires, A Hunter's Guide, by Steve White and Mark McKenzie Ray, the Obaifo are described as a, quote, powerful and parasitic species. White and McKenzie go on to describe the Obaifo as having two spirits, one neutral and one evil. In her seminal work on Obaifo lore, Nan Freeman explains the relationship between an Obaifo and their witch. Freeman writes, "Unlike a witch's familiar, an Obaifo is not a servant. An Obaifo rarely works with a mortal, but romantic relationships are not unheard of, usually with those who sit at the cross-section of the supernatural world, like witches. But the love of an Obaifo is not an ordinary thing. They develop a link with their partner that allows each of them to know always what the other is feeling, to experience two lives at once." So it is not surprising that Kamau knew which island Asa was being taken to. He was experiencing the trip with her, seeing through her eyes and feeling what she felt. But Freeman also explains that, like the power of the gods, the Obaifo's connection to their witch did not extend to the shores of the New World. So while Kamau was able to follow her across the ocean to the first place we knew he visited, he had no way of finding her among the ocean of stolen black faces. There are numerous accounts of his bloody search that extended from the docks where the slaves, for that is what the stolen men and women had finally become, from the docks where the slaves were sold, to the fields and plantations where they labored. Jonathan Miller, a merchant who made a small fortune selling slaves to local plantations, was the first white man to ever record an encounter with an Obaifo. His statement was printed by several local newspapers covering the incident. A few excerpts from these articles are enough to give us a clear picture of what happened. Quote, "The Bloody Princess landed a few days later than scheduled and with fewer bodies than I expected. The captain couldn't explain it, just stuttering and shaking his head like a fool. We accounted for what we had, and the crew went off to drink and do the kinds of things sailors do. We had our next auction scheduled for later the next day, and it was no easy job trying to wash off the stink of the journey. I'm a God-fearing man, so I made sure they were all well-fed and their injuries seen to. A few of the girls were with child, and them we sold separately to people who would wait a while before working them as hard as the others." Miller's statement was published in its entirety, so he goes on to explain the process of washing and oiling the slaves before sending them up to block where the crowd competed for their bodies. This sale, however, would not be like the others. Miller describes the event. We had just sold a boy and a girl, a pair, and I was thinking how nice it was that they got to stay together, when I heard a sound that made my blood run cold. It was like an animal howl, and the scream of an angry man all at once. I don't know where he came from. It was as if he fell out of the sky. A large black man with muscles like chain rope, a shaved head, skin that did not shine from any oil we kept in the back, and eyes like fire. This was nothing like the other incidents. He wasn't a runaway, because they always come in groups. No, he wasn't a man at all. Miller continues. The two guards fired their rifles. They looked like he was bleeding, but didn't bother him. When he reached the first guard, he grabbed his hair and broke his neck like a stick. I heard it all the way at the other end of the room. Then he bit into the guard's neck and started sucking just like a man would drink from a bottle. The other guard kept firing, but most of the bullets just went into the body of his dead partner. Then it was his turn. Same loud crack, and then gross slurping as he was drained. I don't know why I didn't run. I mean, I just never saw a thing like that before in my life. When he turned to look at me, blood dripping down his face, I could see that his teeth were like a wolf or some other kind of animal. By the time Miller decided to run, it was too late. Those slaves on the block who were not chained down ran with the rest of the crowd. Some of them would find freedom out of pure luck. Most of them were rounded up, brought back, and beaten. Kamau did not kill Miller, for reasons that were not properly articulated in his lengthy interview. We can, however, draw some conclusions about what transpired between the two men. Miller had a broken arm and a black eye when the authorities responded, and it is more than likely that Kamau, having identified him as the main source of trade, questioned him about Asa's location. But how could an Obaifo, from the place we will resentfully refer to as Africa from now on, communicate with an Englishman? It is simple. Like other famous men stolen into bondage, Kamau was a polyglot. He had lived a long time. Long enough, no doubt, to learn the white man's language as well as his ways. We can deduce these things because a few days later, the slave trader William Henry was attacked, hung upside down, and drained of all the blood in his body. The slaves he carried were all freed, but again, because they were unfamiliar with the island and not sure where to go for safety, many were eventually recaptured. One slave woman would only say two words, recorded by the local constable, roughly translated from the dialect of her small African village into angel and monster. Next, Kamau would visit the plantation of Henry Combe. Like most wealthy sugarcane planters, Henry Combe did not have much to do with the day-to-day management of the Combe estate. He spent his days in London, socializing with minor members of the royal family and other European gentility. He had left management of the plantation to Winston Baring. Baring was also the typical estate manager, a drunk with a mean streak, who had fled his debtors in England and was making a living from his cruelty. Digging through the papers of the local constabulary, we find numerous citations of Baring for intoxication and fighting right next to the statement of the recaptured slave woman proclaiming angel and monster. We know what happened next because it has become an infamous piece of folklore across the island. Kamau arrived at the Combe plantation, not at night, but in the middle of the day. He walked right up the main road, ignoring the black bodies toiling in the field and the red faces armed with guns that tracked his movement. In the history of the entire island, Kamau might have been the first black man to knock on the front door of a plantation house. The house slave who opened the door would have been shocked. We don't know what he said, but it was effective enough to get Baring himself to come to the door next. Baring was not a man given to writing things down, but we do know that the exchange between the two was enough to send him into a rage. He attempted to strike Kamau and ended up with a sprained arm and a broken leg, later treated by Dr. Jensen, the local doctor. The ever-present men with guns also quickly leapt into action. The punishment for a black man who raises his hand against the white one has mostly remained unchanged since the events being described here. Luckily, these men did not have experience with an Obaifo, against whom bullets are ineffective. Kamau escaped by climbing the side of the house like a monkey, eventually disappearing into the forest at the back of the plantation. We are also told, in a fascinating detail, that the slaves in the field never once stopped the steady swing of their machetes as they gathered the bundles of sugarcane. Kamau would return later that night. This time he did not go to the main road, but instead crept through the high sugarcane stalks and made his way to the collection of huts where the slaves slept. Baring had suspected that the man would return, and so the estate manager had recalled all his guards. They were at the house, as if that was where the only value was. The fateful events that followed may be a turning point in the history of the island, and perhaps the entire New World. Here, the details are very important, and for reasons soon to be revealed, we lose our original source. What we do have is the previously unpublished narrative of the slave John Black. Black, whose narratives were previously dismissed as fiction, was a boy on the Combe Plantation, and he claims to have observed Kamau in his search for Asa. Black details what he saw. "I was just old enough to go into the sugarcane field with the men. I was laying down on the dirt floor of my hut, the gift of every working man. We had all heard about the one who came to the house earlier, but like most of us, my mind was in the prison of exhaustion, so while I heard it, I did not understand. But I still knew immediately that the animal screams I now heard must belong to that same creature. I walked to the door and saw the same man with shining midnight skin. He was looking into the room of the new girl, whose name they told us was Liza." Black continues, "I watched him fall to his knees and scream again. The sound made my stomach tighten and my heart beat fast. His hands were red with blood when he turned around and his eyes were glowing like the dying coals under the big pot where we had eaten earlier. I knew what had happened to her without looking, because she had been a pretty black girl with spirit. It happened all the time back then, before labor got too expensive to throw away. When he looked at me, he was more animal than man. I don't know how to explain it, but I saw him think about tearing me apart. Saw the deed in detail written on his face. But then he turned to the house and was gone, running so fast that it was like he disappeared in the night."